Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And coming up, what if? What if Scotland actually does it? What does that mean for the rest of us?
But first, Australian police announced today that they've stopped a plot by Australian followers of ISIS or ISIL to behead an Australian citizen. Prime Minister Tony Abbott told reporters that police raids came in response to intelligence reports that there was a call from the Middle East for followers back home to kill.
Quite direct exhortations were coming from an Australian who is apparently quite senior in ISIL, to networks of support back in Australia to conduct demonstration killings here in this country.
Reporter Stuart Cohen is based in Sydney. And Stuart, what do we know about this man? Police say called on Australian followers of ISIS to conduct a beheading.
This guy, whose name is Mohammed Ali Bariele, is a former nightclub bouncer and even an actor from Sydney. He appeared in a bit role in one of the TV shows on Australian television here. But he became radicalized and went over to fight with the ISIS militants in Syria. And at this point, it's thought that he's responsible for about half of the 60 or so Australians who are over in the Middle East fighting with ISIS now. They have issued an arrest warrant, and if he ever comes back onto Australian soil, he'll be subject to arrest. But obviously, while he's fighting with ISIS in the Middle East, there's absolutely nothing that they can do to get him.
Well, meanwhile, 800 state and federal police officers raided more than a dozen locations around Sydney. This is, we understand, the largest counterterrorism raid in Australia's history, 15 people being detained, including, we're reading, a 22-year-old who appeared in court. Prosecutors say he was involved in this plot. What more do we know about the people who were detained on Australian soil?
Well, many of them are Afghan Australians, either Australian born of Afghan descent or Afghan refugees or people who have moved to Australia from Afghanistan. That's about all that's really known about them. They were arrested in the western suburbs of Sydney, which tends to be a very sort of immigrant-heavy section of the city. Now, there was another operation going on up in Brisbane, a few other arrests, and this was thought to be linked to a couple of arrests that happened last week. There were two people arrested for recruiting fighters for and raising money for the ISIS movement.
Well, we know last week Australia raised its terrorism threat level from medium to high, but what's the tone there, Stuart? Is the conversation about ISIS there as elevated as it is, for instance, here in the U.S.? I mean, did this come as a shock to people, or was there a sense that there were followers in the country? Give us some context for this.
There is some talk, obviously, about terrorism. There is a bit of an anti-immigrant sentiment that pervades Australian society. And it's thought that this sort of anti-immigrant sentiment is in some ways what contributes to helping a lot of these people who turn to radical Muslim feel sort of disaffected and disconnected from Australian society in the first place. Obviously, the terror alert level was also raised just a couple days before Tony Abbott, the Prime Minister, announced that he was committing 600 Australian military personnel to the coalition that the U.S. is putting together to combat ISIS. Now, keep in mind, too, Australia has never actually been the site of a terrorist attack. And I think they want to keep it that way. If you remember back in 2002, the Bali bombings that happened in Indonesia, those actually targeted Australian tourists. Mm-hmm. And that was thought to be in retaliation for Australia backing U.S. policies in Afghanistan and Iraq. So that terrorist attack, even though it was in Indonesia, killed 88 Australian tourists. And that still weighs heavily on the Australian psyche. So while there has never been a terrorist attack here, they feel that they are potential targets, obviously, and don't want to see any terrorist attack happen on domestic soil.
Well, you mentioned the Prime Minister's joining in President Obama's call to send troops to target ISIS terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Conversely, is today's news maybe going to make people more hesitant to back that?
Well, there are already members in Parliament, certain senior members of opposition parties in Parliament, who have already said, even before this happened last week when the Prime Minister announced that he was going to commit these troops, they said that that's just going to inflame anti-Australian sentiment and make things more likely that there will be a terrorist attack. There are obviously members of the Muslim community here in Australia who are worried that because of the raids today, that their community is going to be subject to a certain anti-Islam backlash. So there is some real concern from them about what these raids mean. And there are a few people who are concerned that this is just sort of going to inflame sort of a general feeling of, you know, lack of safety in Australian public.
Reporter Stuart Cohen in Sydney, Australia, by Skype. Stuart, thanks so much.
Robin, you're welcome.
Okay, well, as we speak, the people of Scotland are voting on whether to go independent from the United Kingdom. And we're going to take a few minutes now to think about what it would mean for the rest of the world if that were to actually happen. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He's with us from New York. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here.
And let's start with the ripples that may happen in other places that want independence.
So I think there are sort of three buckets to think about here. You have economic consequences, self-determinism consequences, and then sort of international political consequences. Let's go through them quickly. First, economic. Scotland will have to determine its own currency, what's going to backstop the currency, what to do in the event of a recession, who's going to set monetary policy. This is all extremely uncertain. Markets hate uncertainty, and I think there's going to be a large negative response if Scotland does vote for independence. On self-determinism, if you see Scotland break away, it's going to empower other groups throughout Europe to potentially break away, one of those being Catalonia in Spain, which has a vote in the next few months. And then finally, you have this issue of international politics. Scotland breaking up from the UK is going to have implications for the UK's internal politics that could potentially break it off from the EU. And any sort of fragmentation in the EU is going to deprive the US of a major international ally. So it sort of ranges the gamut from economic to political, and it could be extremely complicated and consequential.
Well, explain that last one. And by the way, when you talk about places wanting to break away, we just had a story on the show the other day about how China was very worried about this news getting out all across China that Scotland wanted to break away from the United Kingdom because they were worried about some of the regions within China possibly wanting to do that after seeing this. But what about that issue of the UK politically and whether they would then leave the EU? Tell us more about that.
This is really interesting. So try to follow this chain of events. If Scotland breaks away from the UK, Scotland is considerably more liberal than the rest of the island. So you leave the composition of Parliament considerably more conservative. Imagine, for example, if California broke off from the U.S., the remaining U.S. government would be more conservative because California is a liberal state. If Tories take control of Parliament, they could potentially argue for the U.K. to break away from the EU. They think it pays too much attention to Brussels. If they do break away from the EU, a weakened European Union potentially hurts both Europe's economy and weakens the U.S. by depriving us of a unified foreign policy partner as we're trying to make a strong stance toward all of these other governments that are not cooperating when it comes to peace-loving in the way the U.S. would like to see it in Russia and Ukraine and the Middle East. So you can see that this little vote that's happening on North Britain could have major implications for the rest of the world.
Meanwhile, what about the pound? I was talking to – certainly we've seen the pound drop in value since this all started. But I was talking to somebody today who lives in the UK, but he's an American. And he said to me, I'm so glad that I get paid in dollars given what might happen to the pound. What do we know about what would happen to the pound?
If this recession and long recovery dating back to 2007, 2008 has taught us anything, it's that you should own your own currency. The countries that lasted the recession and recovery the best controlled their own currency. What is going to happen potentially if Scotland breaks off from the UK politically, economically, but still relies on the pound, as some people have said, then that means that its monetary policy is going to be based out of London. This creates a really ironic situation, it seems to me, because the central irony of Scottish independence is that they want to break away. One of the reasons they want to break away is that they're really angry at London for enforcing austerity, for cutting spending and raising taxes. But what a country operating on another country's currency has to do in an economic recession, as we've seen in the last few years with Spain and Italy and Portugal, is that if they don't control their own currency, they have to exact austerity. So ironically, it does seem to me that Scotland could be setting itself up for the same kind of austerity that is inspiring, in a way, this independence vote.
What about global stock markets? I remember when Cyprus almost left the euro currency, there was a panic for a moment in global stock markets. Would that same thing happen if Scotland were to go independent?
It's hard to know exactly what's going to happen in the stock markets, but what we do know is that Europe is already a disaster. In terms of GDP, this recession is actually tracking below Japan in the 1990s and America's Great Recession in the 1930s. That's just GDP. And income inequality has also grown in the UK. So you put that together, and it's not just a case that the UK is barely growing, but all that growth is actually happening at the top of the income ladder so that average, typical Scottish and Irish and English people aren't benefiting from what is already a pretty terrible recovery. So I do think that you're going to see just a lot of confusion. And the market typically reacts to confusion by selling so that it can bet on confidence on parts of the market that it's more confident about.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. As we wait for the results of the vote in Scotland, we'll get them sometime tomorrow. The voting continues today. Derek, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I strongly encourage the United States to give Ukraine a special security and defense status which reflects the highest level of interaction with non-NATO ally.
That's Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko speaking to a rare joint session of Congress today and asking for something like NATO member status. And we want to get the view on that from Kiev. Olga Bielkova is a member of the Ukrainian parliament. She's with us now. Olga, welcome back.
Hi, Jeremy. Glad to be back with you.
And what did it mean to you to hear that from President Poroshenko and to have him visit the United States and speak before Congress?
Well, first of all, I'm very proud of his visit. Very kind welcoming of his visit, both in Canada and in the U.S. Secondly, I can only say that I strongly encourage American audience and American political elite to listen to Mr. Poroshenko's plea of supporting Ukraine by giving this status. I think it's a very special attempt in stopping war in Ukraine.
Well, and even as Mr. Poroshenko was traveling to the U.S., the fighting continued on the ground back home. A dozen people killed in the eastern part of Ukraine yesterday. What are things like at this point in the east?
Well, it's hard for me to comment because we are very happy. We have some hope that the recent loss will actually contribute to peacemaking process. There is a new set of negotiations which are about to start in Minsk. So we do have some hope, but unfortunately you are right. But, 12 people or 20 people are not hundreds of people as it was a few weeks ago. So we have some optimism, but unfortunately some news are very sad.
Well, and perhaps when you talk about new laws, you're speaking about a new law just passed this week that gives more autonomy to pro-Russian rebels in the east. That was a law that was praised by Russia, but a top rebel essentially rejected the law, saying it was a starting point, but we do not accept any political unions with Ukraine. So where does that leave things?
Well, that's exactly the point. You know, those who are running these groups of terrorists, they are not representing what real people from Donetsk and Lugansk want. People from Donetsk and Lugansk, they want peace, they want water, and they want their kids to go to school. And this is not what terrorists want. They don't want to negotiate. They don't want any peace with Ukraine.
This all started last year after the former Ukrainian president Viktor Yanukovych decided not to sign that agreement that had been under negotiation to strengthen ties with the European Union. He was making more of a move toward Russia. That started those protests in the Maidan Square in Kiev. Do you think that you're better off today in Ukraine than you would have been if people had just accepted what Yanukovych had done?
Ukraine is fighting for freedom, not for 20 years, but for the last 300 years. And we've seen in our history ups and downs. But I think this time, with the help of our international partners, we are very close. Unfortunately, we had to pay very high price, which we all regret. But there is nothing which will stop our determination to be part of European family. And I'm positive that with all the attempts by President Poroshenko and the current parliament and new parliament, we will succeed.
Olga Bielkova is a member of the Ukrainian parliament, speaking with us from Kiev. Olga, thanks again.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, in eastern Ukraine, people are picking up the pieces after a summer of intense fighting between government forces and pro-Russia rebels. The BBC's Paul Adams traveled to the city of Luhansk, where thousands of people still depend on handouts and have no electricity or water.
A city in mourning, Russian Orthodox priests offering prayers for the victims of the government siege. Slowly and with no real sense of optimism, Luhansk is coming back to life. Under a green tent, a quiet line of grateful citizens waits for a decent plate of food, thanks to one of a handful of soup kitchens operating across the city. There's still no electricity or water, so thousands of people depend on places like this. I find Anatoly Bukhalov sitting alone in the corner. When he finds out we're from Britain, he breaks into song.
Back in the US, back in the US, back in the USSR.
Anatoly used to sing back in the USSR with a college band in 1969. It nearly got him thrown out. His face lights up when he recalls his rebellious past. But when we talk about Luhansk today, he despairs. Some say the fighting will start again tomorrow, he says, that there'll be bombing again. No one is saying tomorrow will be better. So we've come now to a warehouse belonging to a drinks company in Luhansk. And for now, it's absolutely full to the ceiling with boxes of humanitarian aid. These boxes here with red crosses on them are all part of the aid that was delivered on a big Russian convoy of 220 vehicles that crossed the border and came to Luhansk just a couple of days ago. There are plenty of damaged buildings in Luhansk, but some of the city's outlying villages were devastated by weeks of fighting and government shelling. Here in Hreshatova, there's barely a house intact. Many have been demolished entirely. I'm just peering in through the window of this house here. A small house, but a complete charred, broken wreck. Not a thing left intact inside. Another queue, this time for the water truck, which has only just started coming to the village. For a while, during the fighting, it was simply too dangerous. Now, it's a vital lifeline. I meet Alexander, filling buckets to take back to his damaged house. He and his family only emerged from their basement 10 days ago.
He says his house is without a
roof and everything's burnt up.
And do you think it's over now? No, you think it's going to start again?
Should
I hope not?
Well, this really is a rather apocalyptic scene. I'm at a crossroads and I am surrounded by the twisted, burned out, devastated wrecks of a dozen or more armoured vehicles. This is a place called Latugane. It's about half an hour south of Luhansk, and it's where on August the 31st, a retreating Ukrainian army convoy was utterly destroyed. This must have been a really terrifying scene. This was precise, ferocious work, possibly carried out by Russian helicopters. A reminder that if the ceasefire collapses totally, Ukraine's powerful neighbour is unlikely to stand by and watch.
The BBC's Paul Adams taking us to Luhansk in eastern Ukraine.
Used to be, if you wanted milk from a cow, you had to get it by hand. Then came machines a farmer would attach to a cow's udder that pumped the milk out. Well, on more and more farms these days, robots are doing that chore, cutting labor costs, increasing yields, and teaching farmers about the health and productivity of their herds. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Vermont Public Radio's Charlotte Albright stopped by one farm in neighboring New Hampshire to watch an agribot at work.
Cows have been giving milk at Talendo Farm in Orford, New Hampshire, since 1956. That's when Nate Tuller's grandparents started the dairy business. A rambling white farmhouse and aging silos still stand alongside a much newer red metal barn. There are 450 Holsteins to milk several times a day, plus a lot of calves to move from outdoor nursery pens into stalls. Pretty labor-intensive. So a few months ago, the Tuller family bought four robotic milkers and moved them into the new red barn. Interior fences guide cows to platforms beside the robots. They look like red refrigerators in the center of the building.
Let's see if one will come in this end. It's like a guessing game as to when they're going to come in and who's next.
A guessing game because the cows can amble into the milking area pretty much whenever they feel the need. But just to add incentive, a bowl of grain strategically sits where the cow can be reached by the robotic milker. When a cow arrives and starts munching, the robot's many arms get to work.
Two brushes go underneath to clean the feet. They're very soft and they have a disinfectant on them. Once the feet are clean, the brush swings out of the way, and a laser will turn on.
The laser spots the cow's tag so that the computer can identify her. Then four plastic tentacles with suction cups grope around until they attach themselves to her udders.
This cow, on average, is in here 7 minutes and 40 seconds, and she probably gives around 30 pounds each time in.
Since most cows visit the robots more than twice a day, they produce more milk than they did before the robots arrived. The robot keeps track of how much. It can also detect abnormalities in the milk, check the cow's health, even give the exact period of time when optimal insemination should take place. Milking robots aren't cheap, about $125,000, plus barn improvements needed for the machines. But standing on a steel balcony overlooking his operation, Tuller says each robot frees at least three human workers for other chores and for family time.
I've got three kids, and I hope to be able to make more events more easily because there won't be a rigid schedule for chores.
Cows do need to be trained to set their own milking schedules, but after about 8 weeks at Talendo Farm, only about 25 out of the 450 cows need to be humanly led to their work sites. And while the initial investment is still, for many, a risk, it can also keep a solvent family farm in business as older, perhaps less computer-savvy relatives retire. One Vermont dealer for the robot says he sold over 50 so far, with an average of 3 per farm. For Here and Now, I'm Charlotte Albright.
Today's historic vote on Scottish independence is gaining a lot of attention here in the U.S. More than 8 million Americans have some Scottish ancestry, including the two hosts of this program. And there are also Scots living here in the U.S., including Jack Crombie. He moved here from Scotland 30 years ago and is co-owner of the Duke of Perth. That's a Scottish pub in Chicago. Jack, thanks for joining us.
On a great, exciting day.
Well, how are you feeling today?
I am very excited. It's the culmination of weeks of build-up, and the day has finally arrived.
And you are a yes vote, or if you would be, if you were living in Scotland. Am I right about that?
That's correct. I wasn't originally a yes vote. I was originally a no vote, and I've come round to a yes vote.
And why is that?
Well, the time is right for Scotland to go forward and take charge of her own destiny and craft the kind of society that is in line with what it wants.
So you're not worried about the consequences of doing that, because obviously there are big consequences if Scotland were to step away from its union.
You know what? It needs to take responsibility for its own actions. I mean, I don't see America going back and saying, hey, Britain, I'd like to rejoin with you. You know, the same arguments and the same problems that faced the United States when it took independence will face Scotland. But Scotland will have an easier go of it. You know, all this talk about currency and stuff like that. The United States had a terrible problem with currency when it saw its birth. And, you know, who talks about that now? Nobody, right?
Well, that was a very different time, first of all. Also, the United States is not sharing an island with England.
No, and we will continue to share that island. I mean, nobody, you know, I think the only thing that makes this a close race is that nearly all Scots are very proud to be British. I mean, they like Britain. And Scotland's not going anywhere. It will still be part of Britain. And England, I think, will be a very close partner and a good friend. And that's how I would like to see the future develop. I mean, I'm just incredibly proud of the way this whole thing has developed, the level of the conversation, the engagement of the population. It's been a fantastic exercise in democracy. I mean, blood has flowed in streets throughout the world over such issues. And here in Scotland, they're debating it. They're, you know, they're having a pretty high-level conversation. It's getting a little nasty in the last couple of days, but God knows that's not unusual. And I'm just incredibly proud about the whole exercise.
So you have this pub in Chicago, a Scottish pub. What are you going to be doing tonight? I know that you usually don't allow TVs to be on there, but tonight you're making an exception.
We are making an exception for this day only. We've, you know, since it's like the first election in 300 years, we thought we probably could change our rules for tonight. I think if it's a yes vote, there'll be a huge party. If it's a no vote, I'm not so sure. I think people might just go, you know, all the no voters will go, whew, that was close, and go home and tomorrow wake up and it's just another day and things go on as usual. If it's a yes vote, all bets are off.
You're going to be serving a lot of scotch, you think?
I'm hoping so.
Jack Crombie, a co-owner of the Duke of Perth. That's a Scottish pub in Chicago. Jack, thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And let's turn now from a Scottish brogue to a voice with a southern inflection but no less Scottish pride. Bill Caudle is director of the Scottish Heritage Center at St. Andrews University in Laurinburg, North Carolina. He's also an instructor of the university's bagpipe band. And Bill, we understand that you represent the great migration of Scots to the American South. You tell us Ulster Scots went further south. Your people there in North Carolina represent people from the Highland.
Absolutely. I'm in a region here, the Upper Cape Fear River Valley, that was at one time the largest settlement of Highland Scots within North America until well into the 19th century. So I myself am a fifth-generation Highland descendant.
Yeah, here. And how do you feel about today's vote?
Well, thinking about that with both heart and mind, you know, I don't know how I would handle the vote myself if I were voting today. Hmm. You know, the heart certainly thinks that these people deserve self-determination. You know, you look back historically and think of the leaders that have come out of Scotland, the folks that are representative of the diaspora that were nation builders here in the United States and Canada and other parts of the old British Empire. Then one says, why not? Why can these people not become their own leaders within that context? But then, you know, the heart says, I guess personally, I'm one that sometimes is not the best in accepting change. So, you know, that part of me would probably think, like many of the no voters, you know, what would happen? Are we taking this step into the blind unknown? You know, are we taking this leap of faith with our hearts or with our minds, you know?
What about other Scots where you are? First of all, they've been closely. Is this a big topic of conversation?
Well, I think it certainly has generated a great deal of interest within the Scottish American community and has also perhaps brought Scotland to the forefront in the news, which is a good thing for Scottish Americans. when people think of the United Kingdom, they think of England, as opposed to Scotland, which only represents, you know, less than 10% of the population of the UK. They're not thinking of an area that's geographically different, that's culturally different in a historical context, that's linguistically different in some cases, certainly with the use of the Gaelic language and all. So it is a very different place. And I think for the general public here in the United States, it's maybe brought them a greater awareness of Scotland, which is a good thing.
Yeah, well, yeah, we are certainly thinking of Scotland now. By the way, you mentioned the linguistics. There you are at the Scottish Heritage Center. Just remind us of some words that have made their way to North Carolina from the Scottish Gaelic.
Yeah, people would have thought of, you know, in the old days, people would thought about going to a store and buying things and putting them in a paper bag. They would have called it a poke. Put a, you know, you've heard the old saying, a pig in a poke. Poke or pumpkin is a pure Scottish Gaelic word. We think of walking along in a field and you stump your toe on something protruding from the ground. We think of a stob, another pure Gaelic word. Those are just a couple of examples of things that you know, are still well known here in Southern speak, if you will, that have been brought over and still survive to some degree.
Bill Caudill, director of the Scottish Heritage Center at St. Andrews University in Laurinburg, North Carolina. He's also an instructor of that university's pipe band. We'll have to have you back another day to hear that. Bill, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
So here in the studio, we have a representative of the McGregor clan.
My father's mother, who still makes a mean haggis.
There you go. A McLaughlin here. Some might remember my late uncle, Lachlan McLaughlin. How about other Scottish Americans? Your thoughts about today's vote at hereandnow.org. Terry Gilliam has a new film, but even before the credits, you'd be able to tell that The Zero Theorem is his. It's set in a dystopian future, but one with old-fashioned telephones and alarm clocks and workers on roller skates dressed like Dr. Seuss characters and a man driven crazy by his job and the fact that he once got a call from someone about to explain the meaning of life when he disconnected it by mistake. It feels absurd, like the Monty Python animations Terry Gilliam once created, and important, like the 1985 groundbreaking film Brazil, about another dystopian bureaucracy that threatens to crush a government employee. The Zero Theorem features a hapless employee, but this time of a corporation. Christoph Waltz plays Cohen, a computer engineer waiting for that phone call to come again and trying to figure out the Zero Theorem, as his boss, played by David Thewlis, tells him good luck.
Management's been handpicking talent to crunch it since before I was hired. Nobody lasts. It's a guaranteed burnout project. I worked on it for about 3 weeks when I was a young hotshot, fresh out of school. Drove me barmy. After Zip Tea, I couldn't crunch a bowl of Cocoa Pops. That's why management made me a supervisor. You might have noticed I'm a few raisins short of a full scoop.
And Terry Gilliam joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Terry, we know you worked off Pat Rushen's script, but what when you first received that, it must have felt familiar. Your thoughts when you see the script that's so reminding us of other films of yours.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what I felt when I read it some 6 or 7 years ago. And it's clear that Pat had seen every film I had made. There were little references to it, very clever ones. But it was its own animal. Despite that, it just was full of very interesting ideas and characters that I was intrigued with. And strangely enough, I thought in a way it would be kind of a compendium of many of the things I had done, and then I could take it to another level. In the course of making it, I think it became its own beast.
Yes.
It stands on its own legs.
Well, director, you add pictures, images. Cohen lives in a former monastery. The monks took a vow of silence so they couldn't shout fire when it started burning. I love that. But he opens the door. He's in this surreal Trafalgar or Times Square. So what were you thinking? Oh, it's got to have alarm clocks? I mean, how do you come up with those images?
It's sort of forced upon me by circumstances in many cases because it was made for a fraction of the original budget. So we had to go to Bucharest in Romania to be able to make it. And then once you're in Bucharest and I say this is going to be London in the future, you start making certain choices and you try to fill the streets with posters and billboards all shrieking at you. Our film is a little petite provincial version of Times Square, but it's a chance for me to poke fun at advertising in many ways, and religion. The Church of Batman the Redeemer is very popular in that world. Not at all like this world where Marvel Comics have no influence on the young. And I love how Occupy Mall Street is also used as an ad. Shoppers of the World Unite. So I love the way Madison Avenue always is good at taking political movements and things that have some kind of important political statement and turning them into ways to sell better toilet paper and dog food.
Well, one of the thoughts you have while watching the film is that you, Terry Gilliam, have to go pretty far out to create absurd images nowadays. Times Square is just overwhelming. You could not out Times Square Times Square, except you have the advertising following you so that as you walk around. But
yeah.
But sort of doing that, you know, advertisers are following us on our social media.
Well, I know. It's really what it's about. It's not a futuristic film. Mm-hmm. It's about now. What was interesting when we were preparing it and even when we were shooting it, I kept adding things thinking this is about the near future. But by the time we'd finished, it was already a period piece. Mm-hmm. Things are moving so rapidly now, you can't keep up with the change. Life has become so, to me, overwhelming. I've become like Cohen, the character. Mm-hmm. It's all this information, all this shrieking at me, everything coming at me all the time. I just want to escape. And that's what he's trying to do, yeah, in a sense. And in fact, most of the film takes place within his burnt-out church.
Well, and again, it's a former monastery, and there's these stained glass windows behind him. Is that Christ's crucifixion?
No, it's actually his baptism. The Baptist, because Cohen is waiting for this call, the call that is going to reveal to him the meaning of his life. And the call is the same as the Holy Spirit descending. And so I put that moment when Christ is being baptized and there's this white dove representing the Holy Spirit descending. Jesus got the call at that point. That's why there's also a few doves living in the church offering a Cohen a different kind of call.
That's right, the doves that are in the apartment.
Yeah.
Well, his other search, in addition to waiting for the phone call, is finding the zero theorem. He has to make zero equal 100%. At one point, he says to his boss, nothing adds up. And his boss says, you don't get it. Everything adds up to nothing.
it's a very nihilistic approach to life.
Well, if zero equals 100, that's true.
Well, I put that in. The idea was that I like the idea of trying to prove a negative with a positive, i.e. 100% is positive, zero is negative. And I just thought that would encourage the employees in their task here.
Was that from you or was that from the script?
No, that was me. I just
added
all of those things.
Nothing adds up. No, everything adds up to nothing.
What's interesting is we're working with a computer whiz, and I wanted to make the computers more interesting than normal. I wanted to make them like video games, and I think the future may end up like that rather than just looking at the normal rows and rows of figures and equations come flying through on most films about computers. I just wanted to make it like a game, and it's they're actually called Menger's cubes was the image we were working with. And if you put these cubes in, and each side has a slightly different part of the equation, if you put it in correctly, you can build a physical object that is vast, but unfortunately he keeps putting them in the wrong way and they all collapse again. So it's like Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill.
Well, that's director Terry Gilliam talking about his film, The Zero Theorem, the equation that poor worker's trying to solve. But Terry, we haven't been able to think of you in recent days without seeing Robin Williams' face floating by on a plate. Of course, you know, just one of the great images of all time from your 1988 film, The Adventures of Baron von Munchausen. You also directed him in 1991's The Fisher King. Going back to this Arthurian legend, he played a homeless man searching for the Holy Grail. We are sorry for your loss of such a friend and colleague.
I'm sorry for the world's loss, frankly.
Yeah.
Robin was such a unique, extraordinary human being. Just a week ago, I had to look at Fisher King again, and there is Robin doing really a part that the character is so much like the real Robin, the extremes of utter joyous, exhilarating, wonderful, funny character, and then ultimately the tortured soul who is suffering.
Well, we recommend The Fisher King and also Baron von Munchausen to see that face float by on that plate.
I'll tell you, Munchausen was the first time we worked together, and he ad-libbed so much of that character. He's playing the King of the Moon, and it was hysterical because he can't stop making you laugh.
Well, meanwhile, we want to make sure we reflected on that. But also, question for you. We're scheduled to talk to John Cleese in a couple of weeks.
Who?
Him.
Who?
What would you ask him? What would you have me ask him?
Why don't you ask him to marry you? See if he never gets enough wives.
I'll see.
I think he's a Bluebeard. He's turning into Bluebeard is who he is. I don't know what happens to them. Once he gets rid of them, they seem to disappear.
Oh, boy. Terry Gilliam, his latest film is The Zero Theorem. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And the movie opens in theaters tomorrow. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. When is that interview, Robin?
Oh, it's down the road.
And down the road.
I'm going to ask him.
Can't wait. This is Here and Now.